In the long term, I think the best of the CIO ideals are still with us. It's a commitment to expand into new and uncharted territory. It's belief that workers can organize, that they are a source of intelligence and creativity. It's willingness to tackle the citadels of corporate power, the courage of its organizers. They did face death threats, and they did also die trying to organize unions. It was dangerous and not for the faint of heart. You just have to read Rosa Pezzotta's memoirs about organizing in the rubber industry or accounts of Operation Dixie organizing in the South. Its commitment to democracy and education, its embrace of political and social unionism, its attention to universalistic policies and raising the living standards for the majority.
Welcome to the last episode of Organize the Unorganized, a podcast from the Center for Work and Democracy at Arizona State University and Jacobin Magazine. I'm your host, Benjamin Fong. This is the episode devoted to key lessons of the CIO moment. I interviewed 18 people for this podcast and asked them all about this question. Unsurprisingly, they had very different answers, and I've tried to represent them all in this episode. I'll start with the negative lessons, points where my guests were keen to note the differences between the 30s and the present moment, and here their assertions tended to gravitate around two themes. First, the changed economic situation, and second, the issue of labor law. David Brody and Ruth Milkman.
The CIO represented something special, but if you ask what happened to it was really, in my opinion, essentially structural. That is, it was wedded to a sector of the economy that was not on the rise. And the AFL unions tended to be more flexible and were located where there was more growth taking place over the long term. Going back to the industry that I know, eventually the packing house workers, the CIO union, affiliated with the meat cutters, and it turned into the United Food and Commercial Workers, which is the big union in that sector, and it includes a lot more than what was there originally. But the stamp of the union is the AFL stamp and not the CIO stamp. I'm sorry to tell you that.
The old CIO unions lost their leverage because the industries that their efforts focused on, mostly manufacturing industries, the rug has been pulled out from under them by the employers, first in the form of outsourcing, of moving production away from where unions are strong, either within the U.S., like to the South, or outside the country entirely. There's been a tremendous amount of that over recent decades, which totally undermines the whole logic of industrial unionism. That's one. New technology has also shrunken the workforce in those industries quite a bit over the years. So their kind of base is like an endangered species now. Now that may be changing, by the way, insofar as the current global conflagrations are bringing manufacturing back to the US or making people aware that it's good to have at least some of it here in the United States. That may create new opportunities for manufacturing unions actually to make some kind of rebound. I don't think it would ever be on the scale of the 30s and 40s, but you know, there's something going on there. So we'll see. I mean, I think it's too early to make any big predictions about that.
So the first negative lesson here is that the decline of manufacturing and mass production means that organizing the unorganized today is naturally going to involve different industries than it did for the CIO. A second negative lesson concerns labor law. Whereas the Norris LaGuardia Act in 1932, the National Industrial Recovery Act in 1933, and the Wagner Act in 1935 provided new opportunities for the labor movement, today, labor law is mostly constraining. Again, David Brody and Ruth Milkman.
One of the things that's come out very clearly now, and it's a very good thing, is that people in the whole recognize this, that employers who are not in the union sector, that is, that stands by itself. But if you're not in the union sector, you're anti-union inherently. That is, any place that begins to be organized will use similar ruthless anti-union tactics to prevent collective bargaining from happening. There is this tremendous imbalance of power between employers who don't want to have a union and working people who do. And that's also becoming more apparent that this is the case. That is, it's quite clear that any employer who doesn't want to have a union doesn't have to have a union. He can kill it. They have the ability to do that, unquestionably. And the question that arises, don't we have a labor law? Aren't workers supposed to have a right to organize and have collective bargaining? And so people begin to think about that. What's wrong with our labor law? The labor law is very important, and especially now, because it structures the way in which organizing takes place. And now it's quite clear that the labor law doesn't work. It doesn't prevent employers from killing unions. And as the public becomes more aware of that, there's a greater possibility that the law will be changed in a way that will alter these power relationships. So we're in a kind of transitional moment. And I think that one of the things that has to happen is that there has to be a recognition that the law has to be changed so that the power of employers cannot be used to prevent workers from having the rights that the law says that they have. End of lecture.
CIO style 35% density in the United States? I don't see how that can happen without a change in the labor law. So instead, we get these union cities, places where labor has maintained a foothold. And then there are these skill islands. And maybe tech workers will be part of that mix sometime. Like, that's just sort of embryonic right now. But you could imagine that taking off for the same reasons that it works in medicine or whatever. But I think without a major reform of labor law that undermines the ability of employers to just drag things out forever and defeat union organizing campaigns. It's not that workers don't want to organize. They do. But as we're seeing at Amazon, Starbucks, et cetera, it's really hard given the way the law is. So I guess I think that changing that is probably a necessary, if insufficient, precondition for a real large-scale labor revival.
Ahmed White wondered whether unions might be better off today without the law that did so much to empower them in the 30s.
It's actually kind of tragic with a law that was initially enacted for the purpose of expanding workers' rights and where these expansive definitions have their origin in that thinking. And now it works as a shackle, a prison for unions. It's hard to say that unions would be worse off without the statute. And I say that with full recognition that it does provide some significant benefits, but it's so constraining. So it's a problem, and I don't have an easy solution to it by any means. But I'm glad people are now thinking and talking about different routes, different avenues, different tactics and strategies, and not just demanding more. Just elect some Democrats or give us more money and we'll be fine. That clearly is not the way forward. And I think a significant number of people realize that now.
For White, it's difficult to imagine the resumption of many of the militant tactics deployed in the CIO period, and the explicit prohibition of those things in contemporary labor law plays a role here.
So one of the things that comes to mind when you think about the 1930s versus today, with particular relevance to militancy, is the changed legal landscape. And closely related to that, I think the changed tolerance that people have for the risk of going to prison. So in the Little Steel Strike, more than a handful of people did go to prison for blockading or cordoning plants in Northeast Ohio, for handling explosives that were being used to commit acts of sabotage against company property, to blow up railroad trestles and water mains and things like that. And quite a number of other people are lucky they didn't go to prison, among them Gus Hall himself, who barely avoided being imprisoned on criminal syndicalism charges or something along those lines. if you engaged in those kinds of behaviors today, it's not hard to imagine the consequences that you could face, that those are very real. So that kind of militancy presents some very, very real risk in a world where people are quite understandably less willing to take those risks maybe than they were 80 or 85 years ago. On top of that, one thing that's different today is the functionality of the labor law, ironically, which in many ways, now that it's been up and running all these years, is very effective at proscribing exactly the kinds of militancy short of criminal behavior that workers in the 1930s, including CIO activists in strikes like Little Steel, employed, among them mass picketing. The Memorial Day massacre was, again, I think, framed around a question about the legality of mass picketing. For the workers who were involved in that fray, their activism was an attempt to assert the right to picket in large numbers at that plant where the police had told them you could not picket in large numbers. And they carried signs appealing to the Constitution and to the National Labor Relations Act as sources of a right that they had to engage in that kind of picketing. The irony, or one of the many ironies of the story there, is that in the years that followed, it quickly became clear that the law not only didn't accord these workers the right to engage in mass picketing, but the National Labor Relations Act, as it was eventually amended by the Taft-Hartley Act in 1947, made what they did a specific violation of the labor law. So that kind of militancy is essentially illegal, as are other forms of militancy that workers engaged in back then, including to some degree, the attempt to use picketing as a means of organizing workers in the first place. It's not quite illegal, but it's subject to being proscribed by the labor law, preempted by the labor law. So again, you've got a situation now where on top of the greater cost of engaging in extra-legal militancy, you have a labor law, along with many other laws besides, that also proscribe extra legal forms of militancy, as well as mundane types of labor activism, mass picketing as such.
We meet today in freedom's cause and raise our voices high. We'll join our hands in union strong to battle or to die. Hold the fort, for we are coming. Union men, be strong. Side by side, we battle onward. Victory will come.
Okay, so again, the negative lessons my guest tended to emphasize focused on the differing economic situation today as compared to the 30s, as well as the fact that contemporary labor law, again as opposed to the CIO moment, tends to constrain militancy in very precise ways. The more positive lessons, as you might guess, were numerous, and I've tried to group them into five loose categories, the first of which concerns issues of union democracy. This is actually more on the border between a negative and a positive lesson, as many of my guests felt the CIO did not serve as a great example here. Some CIO unions were quite undemocratic, and some were only interested in rank-and-file participation so long as they needed to win elections, but not beyond that. Elizabeth Cohen.
Well, in the 1930s, I think that by necessity, there was a lot more attention to recruiting the ordinary worker and helping that worker to feel part of this larger project. I think over time, many unions, like the steelworkers, become much more top-down and develop a kind of cadre of leaders who make decisions and send them downstream. In the 30s, I think there was more buy-in and more participation as the unions were forming, because after all, they had to get those cards signed. The labor relations law required there to be elections and signing of cards by a majority of the workers. So they needed that rank and file buy-in. As time went on and the unions were more established, they weren't running those elections all the time, and it became less necessary for survival to do that. And in many unions, as in many institutions in our society, you know, leadership just kind of feels that they can do what they want, and they have a system of many levels of representation, and they just assume that that's good enough. Over the post-war period, there often are struggles within these unions over how much say the top has and how much input the bottom has. In the late 1960s and 1970s, many unions have rank and file movement to protest against this top-down structure, which had grown over time.
But some unions were great examples of democratic unionism, and that democratic culture has persisted on to this day. Robert Cherney.
In the ILWU, when the longshore contract is coming up for expiration and is going to be renegotiated, there's a longshore caucus that meets. The longshore caucus consists of elected representatives from every local, and they meet to discuss what they want in the new contract. And these discussions sometimes go on for weeks and weeks and even months to try to hash out the union's position in a way that every local feels that they have been a part of. Negotiations have been done by negotiating committees that are elected out of the longshore caucus, so that, again, there's a constant rank and file involvement in this whole process. It's really important that a union have that level of democracy. Time and again in labor history, you see when unions have an authoritarian leadership, that leadership loses contact with the rank and file and makes bad decisions.
For Ruth Milkman, a lack of union democracy was not the greatest sin in the organizing phase, but it ended up hurting the CIO once it bureaucratized.
If you can extract union recognition because you're John L. Lewis and you basically control the coal industry and you can threaten to disrupt the steel industry in a country where that's like the fundamental product that everything else depends on, maybe it doesn't matter if you've got anything democratic behind you. On the other hand, when the employer goes after you later and tries to get rid of the union or weaken it or whatever, it does help to have militant rank and file workers there defending it. So that's where it becomes maybe more critical than in the initial winning of recognition. Of course, you can win recognition in a lot of different ways, as we see today as well. Sometimes it is completely top down, and it's because somehow there's leverage from the organization that makes it less costly to the employer to say yes than to keep fighting.
The second category of positive lessons focused on overcoming divisions of all kinds in the working class. Elizabeth Cohen.
The culture of unity is still an important message. Employers always try to divide workers by when they were hired, for example, or to separate out the plants or the warehouses where they work. So I think seeking unity across identity groups, across when people actually joined the company, across the nation, so they can't separate out one locale from another. All of those efforts that made the CIO successful are still important today.
Jeremy Brecker believes the CIO's ability to overcome racial division should serve as great inspiration.
Racial divisions, bad as they are today, the racial divisions in the period that the CIO developed were worse. They involved much more direct violence, violence between white and black workers on the shop, and yet they were able to overcome that, not to create a racial utopia, but to draw on the fact that they could make people recognize, you know what, we are going to have nothing but nightmares unless we get together to fight together.
Back in the 1930s, when the whole country was seething with picket lines, an unknown union poet from New York City, inspired no doubt by his empty stomach and the blisters on his feet, wrote a picket line song, which thousands of pickets took up as they marched on the line. The union is the place for me, the place for working men who want some time to sing and play and money they can spend. On the line, come and picket on the picket line. We'll win our fight for the right on the picket, picket line.
The third group of positive lessons concerns mass organizing. Ahmed White and Nelson Lichtenstein emphasized the meticulous organizing work of the CIO that undergirded much of what outside observers thought to be spontaneous worker activity.
what the CIO's success underscores is the vital importance of organizing, not just as something spontaneous, as it were, or semi-spontaneous, but something that is deeply structured, that is deeply rooted and kind of assiduously cultivated. I think that's an important lesson for people today. And I'm not saying that workers now don't do that kind of work, but I do think there's a dearth of that, and not just in labor organizing, but in political organizing. The CIO's success was built upon its organizers' diligence and its leaders, whatever our quarrels with them, seriousness about what they were undertaking to do. It is not easy. That's clear from the historical record. And I don't mean that simply in the sense that it was dangerous. It was that for some of these workers. They were beaten, threatened, all of that. But it was also difficult in that it was typically tiring, mundane work. And I think that's one of the maybe not so sensational, but quite important examples from the CIO's experience that has a relevance today.
I think all labor historians, I think all social historians should ban the word spontaneity. It does not exist. Nothing is spontaneous. Spontaneous is a word that people who are on the outside use to explain something they can't see, don't know what's going on the inside, or the upper class uses the word spontaneity to explain what's going on below. All social activity, radical, conservative, is part of a world of knowing and thinking and planning. If you're having a civil rights sit-in, you know, it's not spontaneous. And the same was true with the sit-down strikes. There were groups of radicals, groups of unionists who'd been fighting the foreman, fighting the company for months or years. And finally, in the late 1936, early 37, they say, well, look, the only way we're going to do this is to have a sit-down strike. Again, from the point of view of New York newspapermen or even from John L. Lewis on top, oh, that's spontaneous. It wasn't spontaneous. Anyone wants to write labor history, never use the word spontaneous. Got it? Okay.
Brian Palmer stressed the importance of the left in laying the organizing groundwork.
Breakthroughs will never happen unless there is, in some ways, an organized contingent of committed leftists who are both embedded in the trade union movement and willing to fight for new kinds of unionism, but also organized outside of it. I mean, the reason that 1934 happened was that each one of those major strikes in 1934 was led by dissidents, politically committed leftists, either in Mustey's American Workers' Party, Cannon's Communist League of America, or Bridges Communist Party of America. The difficulty we have today is not only has the workers' movement suffered decades of defeats, but the revolutionary left has basically been obliterated. So I think what the lesson of the CIO is, if you want the trade union movement to move forward, if you want social movements in general to push forward into new territories and advance the causes of social justice and a whole series of progressive possibilities, that there simultaneously needs to be a rebuilding of the revolutionary left and a rebuilding of the trade union movement, aligned with the social movements that have become so important in our time, but that without connection to the trade union movement, they will be handcuffed in their capacities to affect the kind of broad social change that they want.
William Jones finds the organizing orientation of the CIO to be needed today as a complement to the social movement mobilizations of the present.
We've gone through a period that may be fading, but I think certainly coming out of the Occupy movement, there was certain elements of this within Black Lives Matter. The idea that organizing is not that important, that what's more important is sort of mobilization and getting people in the streets and being able to build these sort of mass demonstrations. And I think one lesson that we see from the CIO moment is how important it is to have lasting democratic organizations in which working people are represented, that working people can articulate their political ideals and debate them in the context of a democratic organization. And that's what unions really play a role in. It's very hard to replicate that. There are very few organizations that do that, particularly involving working people.
For Dorothy Sue Cobble, a large part of the success of the CIO's organizing laid in a willingness to experiment with new strategies and tactics.
One of the things that I admire most about the CIO was that it was willing to listen to workers. It wasn't afraid of giving workers power. It wasn't afraid of new ideas. And I think the labor movement today needs to fully embrace that approach, to be open to a wide range of union forms and ways of increasing worker power. Contract unionism, for example, is really important. And one friend of mine talks about the new generation not being Generation Z, but Generation U for unions, understanding that embracing collective solutions is really the way forward. But there's just a whole range of approaches to building worker power. Minimum wage campaigns, worker co-ops, worker-owned platforms. So I think that openness to the different needs of workers and the different ways they organize is really fundamental to rebuilding the labor movement.
According to Lisbeth Cohen and Rick Halpern, the CIO's organizing success also lay in its connection of local struggles to national organizations.
You need both national organizers and locally known and respected leaders. It has to be a collaboration between those who are known by the community of workers and those who come in with the skills and networks of a national union, so that if there is a strike, there's access to some benefits, so that there are sophisticated and knowledgeable organizers who know how to actually win these battles. So again, though, it can't be just top-down national headquarters coming in. They need to meet up with locally recognized and respected leaders.
The packing house workers are able to organize outside of industrial North, largely because they're connected to the CIO, because it's a national movement. And the CIO helped create a sense of a national movement, the mobilization of an entire working class that would not have been possible without being part of that larger organization. The CIO in the 30s, it had a what I might call a cosmopolitan orientation. In other words, it took workers from Chicago and said, you're not just Chicago packing house workers, you're part of America's packing house workers. Or you're not just a packing house worker, you're a worker, you're a member of the working class. And that was a very, very powerful thing in this period and helped extend organization into hundreds of other industries.
We shall not be moved.
The union is behind us.
We shall not be moved, just like a tree that's standing by the water. We shall not be moved.
The fourth set of positive lessons concerns raising our expectations of what is possible today. In bleak times, it can seem difficult to believe in transformative change. Brian Palmer.
No matter how bleak things look, and remember how bleak things would have looked in 1933-34, I don't think people today have an appreciation of how decimated the workers' movement was, how devastatingly bad things were for working people in the depths of the Depression in 1932-33. And yet out of that came the upheavals of 1934, which prefaced the larger mobilizations of the CIO in the 36-37 period. As bad as things look today, there are the possibilities of organizing new sectors, of building different kinds of unionism, of addressing the experiences of people who've been locked out of the possibilities of trade union entitlements, and in some senses isolated from the historic struggles of the working class. And all of that was exactly true as well in the mid-1930s. Breakthroughs can be made, even in times that look very inauspicious.
Rick Halpern, Peter Cole, and many other of my guests asserted that the CIO moment produced a real revolution in working class living standards, and that we should believe the same is possible today.
When workers are empowered on the job, they can get a lot done. They can protect each other, and they can transform what can be a dangerous and degrading work situation into a situation where they can take pride, where they can be protected, and where they can earn a wage that will allow them to retire rather than be carried out of the plant. When they can earn a wage that will allow their kids to go to university, they can earn a wage that can allow them to enjoy life. I mean, that's pretty important. And I think it's probably worth saying that a generation of packing house workers, thanks to the UPWA, rode these working class jobs to a very comfortable middle class lifestyle and tried to extend that to others.
The ILWU, even though it's a small union, demonstrates what unions can do. I mean, first and foremost, they can deliver good earnings for the members. And there's nothing wrong in a capitalist economy with wanting a little more. The ILWU workers actually are very well-paid working class people generally, and they're still a small part of the total costs in shipping. They went from, as I think Bruce Nelson one time referred to it, from wharf rats to the lords of the docks, and that radically improved the lives of tens of thousands of people and then their families and their communities.
For Jeremy Brecker, this is all evidence that working people can exercise a degree of control over their lives, contrary to how it may often appear.
People who are divided and, as we say today, in silos, hostile to each other, see each other as enemies, can come together, bridge those divides, move out of those silos, and form a common organization and a common struggle on a massive scale, scale enough to make historical change in the structure of the society as well as in the daily lives of working people. This is something that is not an impossible dream. It's not a fantasy. Is the historical reality. The CIO moment was perhaps the most dramatic exemplar of this.
The final set of positive lessons concerns seizing the moment. For Eric Loomis, the example of the CIO should inspire us to go big.
In the present time, we are in a moment of our history in which there's a lot of, whether you want to say romanticizing or not, but kind of emphasis on individual autonomy and small scale change. And I think that on the labor side of that, that's led to a kind of a romanticizing of the IWW. That's the organization that a lot of particularly younger, but not strictly younger, people are looking to as a kind of an inspiration. There are some good reasons for that. Certainly the cultural productions were amazing. They did great visuals, all of this sort of thing. And there's a focus on a decentralized, individualized way of making change without compromising with the state or anything like that. And I don't have any particular problem with this, except to note that it was an abject failure, that the IWW never really succeeded in American life. Where it did, it disappeared almost immediately after that success. And that there's not a lot of evidence that you can organize the American working class again based on this kind of individualistic means. The CIO brought collective power to the working class. The CIO brought millions of people into a movement by organizing big companies all at once and moving into industries that had never had unions before. And all of a sudden, there are millions of union members in an industry. If we're going to succeed in rebuilding a labor movement today, it's going to happen through size and power. And I think that there's a lot of interest in, you know, independent unions are going to keep independence from those big union bosses or whatever. You're never going to build the American labor movement back that way. There are too many workers in America to rebuild the labor movement in groups of 20 or 30 or 50 or even 100. You need thousands and thousands of people to be joining the labor movement at the same time. Bigness is not something that a lot of Americans are very comfortable with today. Bigness is the way of the future if we want to actually have the kind of collective power that we need to make the change.
Economically, Elizabeth Cohen finds the present moment to be a good time to go big in this way.
The CIO succeeded in the middle of the Great Depression, but their success came towards the end of that depression in the 1930s and into the war, and employers were more motivated to meet them when they felt there were economic prospects that they wanted to make sure they benefited from. So I think today, as the economy is doing pretty well and employers are hiring and desperate to hire more, and they see demand out there for their goods, they are motivated to pay a better wage and to give better benefits. We're seeing that. And so that we need to take advantage of the economic opportunities that, despite all the fears of recession and the warnings that are constantly being made, particularly by the Republicans, we have a really strong economy right now. And I think it's a very good time for unions to take advantage of that.
Politically, Steve Frazier also finds the present moment a rather promising one.
Neoliberalism is rupturing. It's rupturing from the right and the left. It's destabilized. That's frightening because there is a kind of quasi-fascist movement on the right. But for the same reason, for the first time, the labor question is once again a question that people are asking. Obviously, there are strikes. We haven't seen these many strikes and NLRB elections and organizing efforts being made in industries that people for a long time have thought were invincible, like Amazon and Starbucks and so on. There's this enormous concern about inequality. So the lesson for me is seize the moment, that this is the time. The CIO saw that during the Great Depression, and I'm thinking we're headed towards that now.
It's difficult to look back at the CIO and not be intimidated by its organizers' dedication and intelligence in seizing the political economic opportunity of the 1930s. But for Nelson Lichtenstein, we should not romanticize the CIO organizers so much as we should see our own struggles reflected in theirs. If they did it, we can too.
Don't think that the people who created the great CIO unions back in, 80 years ago were somehow super people, supermen or superwomen, or somehow imbued with some sophisticated radicalism. They were identical to you. There was hesitation. They were sitting around. There was fear. Don't just think that this was a land of giants. The labor movement has always grown in spurts, frustration, long years of frustration, and then a breakthrough. And you never know quite when that breakthrough is going to happen, and you have to be prepared for it.
Thank you for making it to the end of Organize the Unorganized, The Rise of the CIO. I thought I'd leave you with the broader reflections of some of the key CIO leaders, including David Dubinsky, Walter Reuther, Harry Bridges, and John L. Lewis.
We have no dogmas, but we shall remain determined to work for an ever-rising standard of living for our workers. We have no timetable, but we shall remain loyal to our traditions in seeking to improve the welfare of our members. Life itself always finds new goals, a new need for which we must fight, for which we must work, and which we must solve.
My main point is that the labor movement is about that problem that we face tomorrow morning. The guy has every right to say, damn it, my union has to do something about that problem. I got it right now, today, not tomorrow, right now, and I expect my union to do something. And I think he's got to say to him, you're right, brother, we're going to do something about that. But to make that the sole purpose of the labor movement is to miss the main target. The labor movement is about changing society. What good is a dollar an hour more in wages if your neighborhood's burning down? What good is another week's vacation if the lake you used to go to or you get a cottage is polluted, you can't swim in it, the kids can't play in it? And what good is another $100 pension if the world goes up in atomic smoke in a war? I mean, don't you see that these immediate things, you can't realize them. They have no value excepting in the context of a society and a world in which these values can be given meaning. And so I don't think you have to be noble to look at it. I think that's a pretty practical look at the thing.
There's only one labor boom in this country, as far as I'm concerned, and that's it. And if I can't put my faith there for the future, or any other worker in this country can't put his faith for the future in that labor movement, I don't know where else to put it.
Of course, we will continue to seek to improve working conditions for the workers of America, to reduce hours over long, to increase wages that fell starvation, and to end the labor of children, to wipe out sweatshops. Of course, we will continue every effort to end monopoly in business, to support collective bargaining, to stop unfair competition, to abolish dishonorable trade practice. For all these, we have only just begun to fight.
Thank you again for listening to Organize the Unorganized. This podcast has been brought to you from the Center for Work and Democracy at Arizona State University and Jacobin Magazine. Thanks above all to Michael McQuarrie, director of the Center for Work and Democracy, for his support of this project from the beginning and for chatting about all things CIO and beyond. Thanks also to Maria Esch at the Center for the promotion work. At Jacobin, thanks to Bhaskar Sankara and Chris Crawford for the support and promotion, Lauren Traugott-Campbell for the design work, and especially to audio wizard Connor Gillies for making everything sound terrific. Thanks also to the Wisconsin Historical Society, the Kiel Center for Labor Management Documentation and Archives at Cornell University, the Walter P. Reuther Library at Wayne State University, the ILWU Library, the AFL-CIO Archive at the University of Maryland, and Rick Halpern for help in tracking down archival materials, digitizing them, and giving me permission to reproduce that material here. Thanks to Shiv Patel for some of this archival help. Thanks to Connor Gillies, Dustin Guastella, Alex Hokely, Scott Jenkins, Jen Pan, Paul Prescott, and Christy Offenbacher for feedback on some of these episodes. And finally and most importantly, thank you to the many guests on this podcast. Jeremy Brecker, Robert Cherney, Dorothy Sue Cobble, Elizabeth Cohen, Peter Cole, David Brody, Melvin Dubofsky, Steve Frazier, Rick Halpern, William Jones, Nelson Lichtenstein, Eric Loomis, Ruth Milkman, Daniel Nelson, Brian Palmer, Lisa Phillips, Ahmed White, and James Young. This project literally wouldn't have been possible without the work of these preeminent labor historians and scholars. All of the source interviews for this podcast, as well as all of the episodes and show notes, can be found at soundcloud.com/organize-the-unorganized.
My last song says about all that I want to add, and it's called It Could Be a Wonderful World. If we could consider each other a neighbor, a friend, or a brother, it could be a wonderful, wonderful world. It could be a wonderful world. Oh, yes, it could be a wonderful world. If each little kid could have fresh milk each day, if each working man had enough time to play, if each homeless soul had a good place to stay, it could be a wonderful world. Oh, yes, it could be a wonderful world. If we could consider each other a neighbor, a friend, or a brother, it could be a wonderful, wonderful world. It could be a wonderful world. Oh, yes, it could be a